Thanks a lot for the invitation, Raghav. It's nice to be there, if only virtually. So I'm going to talk about resurgent asymptotics as applied to physics. Give probably half the talk will roughly be an introduction to that, and then I'll describe some applications to phase transitions. And some of this is based on some work with my former student, Anis Sagmad. And towards the end, I'll talk about some work with a mathematician, Ovidiu Costin, recent work based on resurgence. Okay, so just start off with some motivation. Some of the motivation here are some fairly big problems. We're looking for a non-perturbative definition of quantum field theory, compatible with a lattice, but able to do calculations beyond what's doable with standard lattice techniques. And motivation ranges from continuing between Minkowski and Euclidean field theory and or curved space, or even quantum gravity, the famous sine problem in finite density quantum field theory, real-time dynamical physics and non-equilibrium physics directly from path integrals to be able to do strong coupling problems in this context, and also to study phase transitions using ideas from Liang zeros, Fisher zeros. And the common technical thread in all these problems is to get some handle on a computationally reasonable way of doing analytic continuation of path integrals. So that's largely what I'll talk about. And the two questions I'll talk about today is, one, does this perspective of resurgence actually give some useful new insight? And by useful, I mean computationally useful. And second question, which I'll talk about towards the end, does it actually give you ways to decode non-perturbative information from finite information, from a perturbative expansion? So this can phrase the problem a little bit like this. This would be a Minkowski space path integral, but in computational problems such as instanton type problems or lattice problems, we usually deal with the Euclidean quantum field theory path integral. And the relation between these two is actually very interesting. And the original motivation for problems like this goes all the way back to Airy and Stokes in studying rainbows. And so there's a plot here of the Airy function, oscillatory on one side and decaying on the other side. And the integral representation of the Airy function looks like this. And I want you to think of this as some baby zero-dimensional path integral with an action that's a function of t, but there's some external parameter x. And when this external parameter is large and positive, the behavior is exponentially decaying. When the external parameter is large and negative, it's oscillatory. And we all know this problem very well from optics and from quantum mechanics. The main message here is that real physics, such as this, can be governed not just by a real set of points in this integral, but also by a complex set of points. So this is something we all know very well. But actually the behavior, the transition between these two doesn't happen at x equals zero, it happens in the complex plane. And so if we plot this Airy function, here it's real part in the complex x plane, we see this pi over three type structure here. And these are called Stokes sectors. And there are these special lines at pi over three, pi and minus pi over three, along which the behavior is oscillatory. And then there are lines along zero phase and two pi over three and four pi over three, along which it's either exponentially decaying or exponentially growing along these. And this we also know very well from applications in physics. The important thing to appreciate, though, is that there are actually very specific, precise, non-perturbative connection formulas that relate these various Stokes sectors. And if we just look at simplistic asymptotic expansions of that original integral, we don't see that information. However, this information is encoded in a proper saddle decomposition of the original integral. And that's, as far as we know, the only efficient way to make sense of this oscillatory integral, because if you try to do this as a real integral, it's hopeless, especially when x is large in magnitude. So taking this as motivation from, again, from optics and quantum mechanics, the mere fact that we need complex analysis and contour deformation to even make sense of these types of oscillatory integrals, it's at least natural to explore similar techniques for path integrals. All right, so here's the question, the overarching question. Can we make sense of an expression like this, where we've got some functional integral with some coupling, let me call it h bar, some small parameter? Can we make sense of the idea of decomposing this into a sum of a thimbles? These are functional steepest descent contours in the space of configurations, where along a thimble, the imaginary part of the thing in the exponent stays fixed, so that can be pulled outside of the integral. The real part is monotonic, so that can be, this integral can be controlled very nicely. There is a Jacobian when we integrate along this thimble. And then there's a parameter here, a so-called intersection number, which tells you that as you vary the parameters in the action functional, a certain saddle contour, steepest descent contour, may or may not contribute to whatever quantity you're calculating. So this is in quotation marks with an equal sign. Can we even make use of such a decomposition in general, either as an approximate evaluation of the path integral, or even more fundamentally as a definition of the functional integral, the Minkowski functional integral? Now, it's been written here with just one parameter, h bar, some coupling. But in practice, in quantum field theory, of course, we're going to want to deal with functional integrals involving a cup and h bar, maybe n, maybe masses, couplings, maybe a chemical potential, maybe a temperature, maybe an external field such as magnetic or electric, or in co-space, some gravitational curvature parameters. So this is, of course, a much harder problem. And today I want to talk about the interesting things that happen when you go just from a single parameter, which is the problem that is best understood in the mathematics literature, to adding even just one more parameter. And I'll call them h bar and n. And we'll see that in this infinite n limit, we can arrive at phase transitions by not just looking at, say, fixed n and small, strong or weak coupling, or fixed coupling and large n, for example. We want to treat both h bar and n in asymptotic limits. And I claim that a satisfactory definition or construction or implementation, whatever you want to call it, of this functional integral should be capable of describing these sorts of Stokes sectors and Stokes transitions that change when you change the parameters in the action, which will necessarily affect and change the steepest descent contours, their shape, their topology, whether they contribute to a particular functional integral. And we'll see that in this limit of large n, we can have genuine Stokes transitions where the form of this expansion, even the form of the expansion, changes dramatically across a phase transition. So I need to say a few words about resurgence. I'm not going to assume that people are completely familiar with this. It's a relatively new idea in mathematics. The name comes from work by Jean Eckhall in the early 1980s, but the ideas can be traced all the way back to Stokes. And at one level, you can think of it very simply as a method of unifying perturbation theory and non-perturbative physics. So I'll illustrate that with examples. But at the mathematical level, it's much deeper. It's a way of being able to do all the things that we know and love in complex analysis, such as analytic continuation, monodromy, going from different sheets, to be able to do that not just in the context of analytic functions, but in the context of functions encoded by asymptotic series. So one step in this definition of resurgence is the idea of a trans-series, where instead of just thinking of perturbative expansion in some small parameter g-squared, we also include powers of exponentials, which as physicists we would identify with instantons, and also powers of logarithms, which we would identify with interactions of instantons and anti-instantons, or these things show up also in well-known calculations of high-loop Feynman diagrams. And the idea behind a trend series is that if you have some asymptotic series based on just an expansion like this, it doesn't have all the information about the function you're trying to analyze. Whereas a trend series is constructed to have all of that analytic continuation information in it. So I have to explain what that means and show you some examples. But once that happens, it necessarily means that the perturbative sector and the non-perturbative sector have to be entwined with one another. There's no way you can have the addition of these sorts of things restoring analytic continuation properly without them being related to this. They have to be connected if they can actually work together in the appropriate way. So these ideas of trend series originated in the world of ordinary differential equations in the study of dynamical systems. And it's been very well explored in partial differential equations, difference equations. There have been applications in fluid mechanics. And it's been applied in quantum mechanics and more recently in matrix models, field theory, specifically a lot of work and interesting work in Schoen-Simons theory, and some applications in string theory.
I think Laurent has a question.
Yeah, sure.
Just a technical question. Is it clear that it's enough to restrict to just log and not logs?
Yeah, so I'm giving a brief for the physicist type description here. This is the general form that generally shows up in physics applications, but technically a trend series involves iterations of exponentials and logs of logs of logs. So the big deep theorem due to Eckhart is that if you form the set of functions that are So the result of Eckhart is that if you consider the set of functions, the space of functions that's generated by these powers of a small parameter, powers and iterations of exponentials, and powers and iterations of logarithms, that this space of functions is closed under essentially all operations of analysis. And that's its power. I really don't want to dwell on this because let's talk about it at the end, because this is a talk unto itself and it's not what I want to talk about today. Do I need to say it for a third time or shall I wait till the end? A separate topic unto itself. Okay, the word resurgence, where did this come from? So here's a quote from Eckhart that the set of resurgent functions, if they have a set of singular points or special points about which you can consider these fluctuations, so here these raindrops are showing these special saddle points or critical points or singular points, that resurgent functions, their fluctuations around any given point resurge or show up in an encoded form at the other critical points. So that's where the name resurgence comes from. And so the big claim is that for resurgent functions, which are supposed to therefore be by this result of Eckhart, somehow the set of all functions we'll probably ever need to worry about in physics, that the fluctuations about different singularities or different special points are. What extent this is actually realized in physical applications. Asymptotic expansions rather than convergent expansions, not all. Okay, I don't know what's going on. I just lost connect. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
I have no idea what's going on. Okay. All right. So Borel summation consists of the following procedure, that if you have some asymptotic expansion where these coefficients...
You lost your screen again, though.
So the idea of Borel summation is that given an asymptotic expansion of this form, which is generically what happens in physical applications, where the coefficients are growing factorially fast in magnitude, you define the Borel transform where you divide out this factorial growth, resulting in a Borel transform function of some other variable t, the Borel variable t, And this function typically has a finite radius of convergence. And then the summation of the original asymptotic series is defined as the integral over T of this Borel transform. So just taken at the formal level, obviously term by term, you just reconstruct this asymptotic series. But the power behind this approach is that you've moved the problem of describing the behavior of this asymptotic series here into the problem of characterizing the singularity structure of this finite radius convergence Borel transform function. And the singularities of this Borel function provide a very efficient both physical and mathematical encoding of the global properties of the function you were trying to describe with the asymptotic series. And I'll give examples of this as we go along. I want to stress that this is both mathematically and physically important because you arrive at a much better mathematical description of the function you were trying to describe. But also these Borel singularities are non-perturbative physical objects. So there's some real physics here that is hidden if you just look at the original asymptotic series. All right, and in resurgence, one way of defining resurgent functions is that they have isolated algebraic or logarithmic branch cuts. And so you have endless analytic continuation in the Borel plane. So let's look at an example again. The Airy function, there's a lot of useful information in the Airy function. Let's just think of trying to do perturbation theory for the Airy function. So we start with the differential equation, and we just start generating an expansion at large x, let's say along the real positive axis. And so the Airy AI and BI, there's this annoying factor of two difference in the normalization convention. But these have this asymptotic expansion in inverse powers of actually x to the 3/2 and some prefactor stuff. And the coefficients of the expansion, well, there are two powers of factorial in the numerator and one in the denominator. So there's overall factorial growth of this asymptotic expansion. Now, if you just look at this and try to imagine that this asymptotic expansion defines the two functions, you would immediately think that if I flip the sign of x to the 3/2, that takes me between AI and BI. So a rotation of x by 2 pi over 3 up to a phase that comes from this factor here would relate the BI function to the Airy function along the direction plus or minus 2 pi over 3. But in fact, that's not correct. There's an exponentially small correction that is not seen if you just look at these two terms here in black, which you get from just doing a naive extension of this asymptotic expansion. Now, the way you can see this is that you do a Borel summation. So you divide by n factorial in these coefficients. And that actually then defines this hypergeometric function. And so this would be the Borel sum representation of the Airy function AI. And now you see that the analytic continuation in x through 2 pi over 3, or rotation in either direction through 2 pi over 3, involves also a contour deformation here in the Borel plane and flipping the sign of t. But this function has a branch cut from minus 1 to minus infinity. And it's the jump across the branch cut that's responsible for this exponentially suppressed correction piece. So this is the sort of thing you can do with Borel summation. You can start with an asymptotic series, convert it to a Borel transform representation, and then the singularity structure of the Borel transform encodes this non-perturbative connection formula with this exponentially small contribution that you didn't see if you just looked at the formal series. That's the sort of thing we would like to be able to implement in the world of quantum field theory. And I'll show you some examples. Now, in the opposite direction, we would start just with the original integral representation and try to define the steepest descent contours in the complex T plane. So if I define X to have a real part amplitude R and a phase theta, and we start deforming our contours off the real axis T into the Z plane, then you see that in order for this integral to be well-defined because of this minus Z cubed here, these contours have to end up either going in the along the real axis or along 2 pi over 3 or 4 pi over 3 in order for this thing to be real, z cubed to be real and positive. Other than that, we can deform these contours at will. They just have to asymptotically go in one of these three directions. So we can decompose this integral, this original integral, into a combination of these three steepest descent curves. Actually, they're not independent because the sum of the three of them just adds up to zero. So there are two independent ones here. And remember that as you vary this parameter theta, so you move around in the x plane, complex x plane, you move where the saddle points are and you deform the steepest descent curves. And that's the origin of this so-called Stokes phenomenon. That is, you change the phase, different saddles contribute and different steepest descent contours contribute. And in order to preserve the correct analytic structure in the complex plane encoded in connection formulas like this, it's absolutely necessary that these different thimble integrals have to be related to one another because they have to be able to establish these non-perturbative jumps as you vary the parameters. So this is taking us in the direction of what's called Picard-Lefschetz theory for ordinary integrals, ordinary exponential integrals. And so I claim, I repeat this idea that a satisfactory definition of a path integral should be able to capture these Stokes jumps that have genuine physics in them. So even if you go extend this from this simple one-dimensional integral here to two dimensions or three dimensions, any number of finite dimensions, this is already a very interesting story. It goes under the name of Picard-Lefschetz theory. When you try to generalize it to infinite dimensions, say for functional integrals, it becomes much more interesting. And if you start including not just one external parameter, but multiple external parameters, it also becomes very interesting. And if you go to the world of quantum field theory, where your parameter requires renormalization and will be depending on some scale, it becomes even more interesting. So these are the challenges of trying to apply resurgence to genuine quantum field theory applications. So let me start off with an example from quantum mechanics. So let's look at this simple quantum mechanical Schrodinger equation for the periodic potential, known as the Mathieu equation. And here I have a sketch of what the spectrum looks like. The shaded regions are the bands. And as a function of this coupling H bar, the energy, and each of these bands is labeled by an integer n. So here's the lowest energy band, the next first excited, second excited. And so the energy eigenvalues are labeled not by one parameter, but by two. There's a coupling, and there's also the band label, which is generically viewed as an integer. And I want you to think of this as an analog of nc or nf in a field theory calculation, and this is an analog of a coupling. And the plus minus here refers to the top and the bottom of a given band. So if you just do perturbation theory for a given band with the coupling H bar, you get some formal series in powers of H bar, and the coefficients are functions of n. They're actually simple polynomials of n. But we all know that there's splitting due to tunneling between neighboring wells, and that's an instanton effect. And we all also know that the leading exponential factor for an instanton is e to the minus some number depending on your normalization, some number of h bar. There's some prefactor, which is some power of h bar. And then there are some numerical factors depending on which band you're talking about. But that's only the beginning, the sort of tip of the iceberg. This instanton calculation, which is the exponential factor and then the Gaussian fluctuations, it's also multiplied by an asymptotic series, which are the fluctuations around that instanton. Now, remarkably, that series, that formal series of the fluctuations around the instanton, can be expressed completely in terms of this series. Here's a closed form expression for those fluctuations in terms of the purely perturbative formal series. This is asymptotic, but it can express this completely in terms of this one, and here it is. And there's also plus dot dot here, which is the two instanton, three instanton, four, and all instanton expansion here. This is an example of a trend series. And in this case, remarkably, it really is true that any term, higher order term in this trend series expression from the multi-instanton expansion, they can all be expressed in terms of this guy, this perturbative expansion. So this is an extreme example of this general claim that for a resurgent function, if you knew the fluctuations around one of these critical points, so one of these saddle points, the simplest one, the perturbative saddle point, that information actually encodes the information about any other perturbative saddle point. Here, there being an infinite number of these because this is ultimately coming from an infinite dimensional path integral. Now we can also now that we have these two labels, we can actually start talking about phase transitions. And now look at this plot carefully. The horizontal dotted lines are the top and bottom of the potential. So this is low down in a given well, low down in a given well. This is high above the barrier of this periodic potential. And so you see that down here at small h bar and low n, these are exponentially narrow, these bands, and we learn about that in solid state physics classes. And if you look way up here, very high above the potential, you see that the spectrum is essentially continuous, but with very narrow gaps. And if you look near the top of the potential, if you look carefully, you see that the width of this band is no longer exponentially narrow. And moreover, it's actually equal to the width of the gap. If you look here also, this width is equal to this width is equal to this width, and so on. So you can actually define a TUF parameter, h bar n, and consider the small h bar limit with large n such that it remains finite. And this zeroes in on this transition region between the region of narrow bands to the region of narrow gaps. And this is a genuine phase transition where the physics here is described by real instantons, whereas up here in the gap region is defined by complex instantons. There are no real turning points up here because the energy is above the top of the potential, but there are turning points in the complex plane, and the instantons that go between those actually give you the narrow gap widths up here. And this is the phenomenon of instanton condensation, that as you approach this region here, the one instanton approximation is not very good. You need to sum over all instantons. And as you cross this transition, the physics is no longer described by real instantons, it's described by all orders of the complex instantons. And as you go way, way up here in the spectrum, then the one complex instanton approximation becomes good. So this is quite interesting that from this very, very simple and very familiar quantum mechanics problem, we can actually see this Stokes phenomenon, and we can see this phase transition, and we can see this resurgent structure that all orders of the trend series are encoded actually in the formal perturbative series. And this also maps to some supersymmetric quantum field theories as a one-to-one dictionary style map, which also makes it interesting. So technically, the physics behind this is the distinction between tunneling ionization and multiphoton ionization, which here in the context of the so-called Schwinger effect, pair production in QED due to a background electric field, the one that people are most familiar with is a constant electric field. But if you take a time-dependent electric field that's monochromatic, so it has an amplitude E, but also a single frequency omega, this analysis was done by Keldysh back in the early 60s in the context of ionization with lasers, but was then generalized to the QED case. This was Edouard Brezan's PhD thesis, in fact. The idea is there's a dimensionless parameter which describes the frequency, how big the frequency is in terms of the amplitude of the field. A WQB calculation gives you a rate for this pair production, which is exponentially small with a combination of parameters multiplied by a function of this adiabaticity parameter. And when the frequency is small, meaning this parameter gamma is small, this thing just goes to a constant. We get the familiar e to the minus you know, M squared over electric field type behavior, which is the familiar non-perturbative pair production rate. But in the other limit, where the frequency is very large, this thing develops a logarithmic type behavior, and the exponential of the logarithm gives a power. And the power is interesting because the power is the vector potential divided by MC raised to a power, which is twice the binding energy. The binding energy of the system would be 2mc squared. So this is in terms of the number of photons that you would need to overcome this binding energy between the negative Dirac C and the positive continuum. So this is a transition. This small gamma to large gamma is a transition between the regime where you would expect pair production due to tunneling and pair production going over the barrier, or multi-photon pair production. And this is also a transition. This is technically, the description here is almost identical to this periodic potential problem on the previous slide. And I'd just like to advertise and bring to your attention that there are concrete proposals both at SLAC and at DAISY to try and probe across this transition using combinations of high intensity lasers and the electron beams at SLAC and DAISY. All right, if I'm going to talk about phase transitions, I should say something about the Ising model. It's probably the best known phase transition to most theoretical physicists. So let me keep it simple and just talk about the 2D lattice Ising model without a magnetic field on the square lattice. The diagonal correlation function, so the free energy has simple behavior that we all know when there's a phase transition at a finite temperature, and there's this Cramer's duality between low temperature and high temperature. But let me talk about something more interesting, which are correlation functions. And correlations, spin-spin correlation functions along the diagonal of the lattice, are functions of some temperature variable and of how many steps along the diagonal you take. And this beautiful work of Jimbo and Niwa back in the early 80s pointed out that this correlation function is something called a tau function for a particular integrable nonlinear differential equation called Penove 6. And these correlators have a determinant type representation. So the problem actually where the entries of the determinant are hypergeometric functions. So actually you can linearize this problem into a determinant representation of solutions to a linear problem, namely the hypergeometric problem. It's also known that in the scaling limit, as n goes to infinity, and as you also approach Tc, but some combination of these two is kept finite, it was known even in the 1960s due to McCoy and company that the transition at this point is described by Penlove 3 equation. And nowadays we understand this as a reduction of Penlove 6 to Penlove 3. But what I want to point out here is that there's been some extremely beautiful work by Lisovi and collaborators over the last 6 or 7 years or so, and nicely generalized to something called the Penlove gauge correspondence by this group Benelli et al. That in fact, the asymptotic expansions that Jimbo and Miwa described for these correlators for Penlove 6 can be extended to all orders, and they're described in terms of conformal blocks of conformal field theory. So this thing satisfies a second order nonlinear equation. So there must be two boundary condition parameters, and I'll call them S and rho, the two boundary condition parameters. And the claim, not claim, a result, is that these correlators can be expanded in this instanton expansion, instanton anti-instanton expansion, with some coefficients that are just combinatorial factors involving Barnes gamma functions and factorials and such. And these are just parameters of the differential equation that are things related to N in the case of Airy, capital N. And these guys here are the conformal blocks. So these depend on the parameters of the equation and on this boundary condition parameter. And there's just some overall power of this temperature parameter and then some sums over Young diagrams. So this is the conformal block expansion. Now, in fact, this is resurgence. this demonstrates resurgence. Even though these expansions are all convergent expansions, it's resurgent in the following sense. This is a sum over instanton sectors. And the structure of this expansion says that if you happen to know the zero instanton sector, so you know this function here with little n equals zero, and you know this function here, these functions here with little n equals zero, then you automatically know any instanton sector, because all you have to do is to take this boundary condition parameter rho and add and shift it by some integer to get any instanton sector. So the structure of any instanton sector is encoded in the zero instanton sector. So this all orders result is fairly recent, and it has this nice physics interpretation in terms of conformal blocks. And this implies resurgence for huge classes of integrable models coming from this overall Penove 6 system. All right, I'm running because of these delays. I'm going to have to skip over a discussion of these Penove equations. I'm willing to describe that in the questions if anybody wants. So I think I'll have to skip this. Another interesting example that displays the how trans-series change as you cross a phase transition is in this very well-known Gross-Witten-Waddy unitary matrix model, which was developed as a single plaquette matrix model representing 2D Yang-Mills on the lattice. So here's the partition function, it's an integral over capital N by N unitary matrices. And the action is just a sort of cosine theta type combination of U plus U dagger. So this partition function is a function of this coupling and also capital N. So two variables. And the discovery of Gross and Witten and also Waddier was that there's a correlated limit in which there's a third order phase transition. If we take this so-called Tuft coupling, a combination, and consider G squared small, N large, N going to infinity, but such that this is finite, well, the finite value can itself be bigger or smaller than one. And there's a phase transition when this Tuft coupling is one. The neighborhood of this transition is described by a Penove 2 equation, and the physics of it is actually very similar to this pair production example that I described, and also this periodic potential quantum mechanics problem. It's the idea of condensation of instantons across a transition. Now, this thing has been studied in many different contexts. It has lots of applications in mathematical physics and theoretical physics. And one of the beautiful results from random matrix theory is that it can be expressed using orthogonal polynomial techniques as a finite n by n determinant. So these here are just airy functions, not airy functions, Bessel functions, the modified Bessel functions. And the index of the Bessel function is j minus k for the jkth element. And x here is just the inverse coupling. So that's very nice, but a determinant is not a very efficient way to study the large N limit because large N determinants are very complicated. It turns out there's a nice generalization of this that enables us to study large N. So here's a plot from the paper of Gross and Witten showing this kink in the specific heat as a characterization of the phase transition. The normalization was different by a factor of two, so I'm putting this at Tuft coupling equal to one, just for convenience. So in a large N expansion, we would typically do something like this, expand in powers of inverse powers of capital N, and there would be coefficients that are functions of the other variable, the Tuft parameter. But in fact, there is an entire trans-series expansion with exponentially suppressed terms. And what I want to show you is how you can describe those trans-series terms and how they change as you go from this region to this region. The whole structure of this trans-series undergoes a transmutation due to this condensation of instanton effect. So it turns out there's an order parameter. It's not strictly speaking an order parameter, but it's a parameter that changes dramatically as we go across the transition, which is the expectation value of the determinant of the unitary matrix. It can be expressed as a ratio of determinants of Bessel functions. But the more interesting representation is that this thing satisfies a third order nonlinear differential equation in the Penleve 3 class of differential equations. So the variable here is t, this TUF parameter. The derivatives here are with respect to t. And n appears only as a parameter in the differential equation. So in particular, n doesn't even have to be an integer now. N can be complex for all we care. Having it in this form makes it extremely straightforward to generate large n expansions and to study the trend series form, because the simplest, best known context in which to describe resurgent trend series is in the context of nonlinear ordinary differential equations. So for example, the infinite n limit is easy. We just focus on these two terms. And now you see it's just a completely algebraic problem to express delta in terms of t. And then we can build the large n expansion using just formal expansions in this differential equation. I should say that all quantities such as the free energy, the partition function, the specific heat can be derived by simple operations on this order parameter. So for example, at weak coupling, this leading behavior from setting capital N equal to infinity is just found algebraically as square root of 1 minus t. But then I can develop an expansion where these coefficients are just functions of t. And you can, you know, with mathematics, you can generate as many of these as you want just by plugging this into the differential equation. You can also study the exponentially small corrections, again, just by plugging into the differential equation. It will give you a differential equation that determines this weak coupling large N instanton action. It has this form here. It determines the prefactor, and it also determines the subleading fluctuations around that leading large N instanton and all of the remaining terms in the trend series. So that's extremely easy given such a differential equation. You just insert an ansatz and expand. Now we can study the large order growth of these coefficients to see whether this large capital N expansion is asymptotic or not. And indeed it is. Those coefficients grow like 2n factorial. And there are powers of exactly this action here as predicted by resurgent asymptotics. And the subleading corrections have not gamma 2n minus 5 halves, but gamma 2n minus 7 halves, et cetera. And there's a very specific function of t. So this is true for all t less than one, this expansion. And now resurgence says that the behavior of these coefficients should be related in a very specific way to these coefficients and so on. Well, given the differential equation, it's a simple matter to generate these coefficients. And you discover that the first few terms of this fluctuation around the one large N instanton, the coefficients match exactly the coefficients of the large order behavior of these. And that's a generic type of behavior of a resurgent trend series. The difference being that here we're seeing it at work in a two variable trend series where the expansion is in powers of capital N. So 1 over capital N is like the h-bar parameter from before. And these relations are true for any t, the other parameter, provided t is less than 1. So that's a demonstration that these resurgence relations also occur beyond just having one single parameter. Now, at strong coupling, the form of the trend series is completely different. It's now only an expansion in exponentially suppressed terms with their own fluctuations. There's no perturbative contribution. And the strong coupling action appearing in the exponent here is a different function of t. They agree when t equals 1 at the phase transition, but they're different on either side. The whole structure of the trend series changes as you go through this transition, and this is an analog of going from the multiphoton to the tunneling regime through a condensation of instantons at the transition. And the transition is also described by Penleve 2, just like we saw before. There are also these large order, low order relations in the trend series at strong coupling, even though this trend series has a very different form. So this example, this gross wooden Moitié model, is a very clear demonstration of the of how a transition occurs within the trans series description. It also has a nice interpretation in terms of Li Yang zeros. I can discuss that a bit more at the end if you like, but let me push on. I want to spend the last 10 minutes so describing some recent work with Ovidiu Costin, who's a mathematician and responsible for many of the results in both Borel summation and asymptotics and resurgence. So the question we want to ask is, okay, this is all well and good, and I've shown you various special examples where things work nicely. Many of these examples were so-called integrable models. I will stress that everything about resurgence does not rely on integrability. Integrability is a particular subset where it's possible to demonstrate resurgent properties with great detail, but it's in no way essential for the discussion of resurgence. So in a really difficult problem, something like Yang-Mills theory, or something like 2D Ising model, also with a magnetic field away from criticality. These sorts of problems where the best hope we have often is that we have some finite number of terms of an asymptotic expansion from perturbation theory. We can all think of examples like this in our own context. The question is, can resurgence actually do something for you here? Can it help you to decode some non-perturbative or global information about your problem from some finite amount of perturbative input? So when you first think of a problem like this, you think it's just hopeless. And I want to convince you that actually you can make surprisingly great progress using some of these ideas of resurgence in this problem. All right. So the initial idea is that resurgent functions have an orderly structure in the Borel plane. So you're presented with some beginnings of an asymptotic series. You look at it, you don't see very much. You convert it to the Borel plane, you start to see evidence of possible singularities of the Borel transform, and they typically have some orderly structure. They're not randomly distributed around the Borel plane. And that structure can be used to develop extrapolation and summation methods that take advantage of that orderly structure, which you don't see if you just look at the asymptotic series itself and start doing ratio tests and things like that, and acceleration of series tests. So I'm going to show you an application in the world of Penleve 1, but I stress that integrability is not important at all for this method. We studied Penleve 1 because it's of interest in physics, but also it's widely viewed in the asymptotics world as a test case. It's in some sense the harmonic oscillator, that this is a crucial test to show some improvement of some extrapolation methods. So let me show you the equation. Here's the first of the six Penleve equations. It's in some sense the simplest, but it's also in some sense the most complicated because it doesn't have any external parameters in it. So it's just a quadratic nonlinearity. If you look at this equation for a while and look at large X, you see that it has an expansion in inverse powers of X to the 5/4. I've taken out some other factors to make these coefficients nice rational numbers. And there's an overall factor of root x at the front. And these are easily visible from just looking at the equation for a little while. Given an expansion of this form, you can put it into this differential equation and generate lots of these coefficients. And it's a simple iterative procedure to generate lots of these. But of course, that can't be the answer, because this is a second order differential equation, and here I've just given you a solution with no parameters. So we're missing some boundary condition parameters. So there's something missing. And what's missing is the fact that this is a formal asymptotic series, and so there's a trans series completion of this solution lurking here. So So the question is, if I just give you a certain number of these coefficients, can you learn about those extra pieces that are missing? And a small number could be something like 10. So what's known about the Penleve equation? So it's known, it has this very intricate structure in the complex plane. It has a five-fold symmetry of Stokes sectors. And there's actually one preferred sector for this particular solution here that I've shown you. There's a 2π/5 wedge in which there are poles, and there are no other poles in the other wedges. So this is a particular, extremely finely tuned solution of this Penleve one, where I fixed both of these boundary condition parameters to specific values. This is the most intricate type of phase transition you can construct in this equation. So the question becomes, if I give you an asymptotic expansion around x goes to plus infinity, and if I only give you a finite number of terms of that expansion, and that's all you know, the question is, from those coefficients, can you learn about the rest of this? And most interestingly, can you cross here and into here into this so-called pole region? And the crossing these Stokes lines and anti-Stokes lines are examples of phase transitions. So of course, if you had all the information about all the coefficients and you knew the exact Borel transform, then it would be like what we were talking about before, but that's not possible here. So a very old result from Boutroux more than 100 years ago is that these asymptotically have this five-fold symmetry in the general problem, but a conjecture, a much more recent conjecture due to de Broven, is that this particular solution will have poles only in this wedge here. So Boutroux, for a general Boutroux solution, there are poles everywhere in the complex plane, but for this de Broven type solution, this so-called tritonqué, they're only confined to this region here. So they're, if you like, as far as possible from the starting point over here. So somehow this expansion at large x has to turn into a completely different function as they cross these boundaries. All right, so here's what this resurgent extrapolation and applications of Borel summation and resurgence ideas. Here's a plot of the poles that you generate from this expansion, starting just with information out on this real axis. And so it's possible with about 100 terms in that expansion to see quite clearly the first 66 of these poles. And the structure of this expansion is completely different as I cross this series. And I stress that the only input information used here was a certain number of coefficients here. And amazingly, if you just give me the first 10 coefficients out here, I can see these first three poles here. So this extremely sensitive non-perturbative information here is encoded in just a small number of coefficients out here. So to stress the precision of this, the expansion of the solution at large positive x has this form, but in this pole region, it's known that the expansion has this form. It has a quadratic pole and then corrections, and the two parameters are the location of the pole and the other coefficient. And starting with 50 terms out at plus infinity and extrapolating, this structure is recovered to 30-digit precision, including the identification of the location of the pole and this other boundary condition parameter. And just for reference, this equation is used in numerical analysis as a standard test case, and the precision going through here is the best precision those algorithms have is about 15 digits of precision. And here it's completely trivial to upgrade this to 100 digits of precision just by taking more terms. So why is this happening? So it turns out there's actually a theorem, and this is in recent work with Ovidiu Costin, there's actually an optimal way of extrapolating within the world of resurgent functions. And it involves doing Borel summation and either conformal maps or uniformizing maps. And you can get dramatic improvement using these techniques. And the improvements are both in precision, but also in range within the complex plane. where you can do a proper analytic continuation. So frequently physicists use this idea of combining Borel summation with Padé approximants of the Borel transform to describe the singularity structure of the Borel transform. But there's a problem with that because Padé is representing a truncated expansion, a polynomial, as a ratio of polynomials. So the only singularities it can possibly have are poles. But suppose, as is often the case, that the actual singularity of the Borel transform is a branch cut. Then Padé represents that branch cut as a line of poles accumulating at the branch point. But for resurgent functions in nonlinear problems, these branch cuts are repeated at multi-instanton expansions. So if you do a Padé analysis of the Borel transform, these higher repeated multi-instanton terms are hidden. They're obscured by the poles that Padé puts there trying to represent the first branch cut. So it turns out there's a way around that, which is to use these conformal and uniformizing maps. Let me just show you quickly an example. This would be in this one of the Penove examples. Here's a plot in the complex Borel plane of the singularities of the Padé representation of the Borel transform. And you see it's trying to represent a cut from I to I infinity and minus I to minus I infinity. But in fact, there's a whole series of branch cuts hidden here. There's one starting at 2i, 3i, 4i, 5i. And if you make this conformal map, or even better, a uniformizing map, these branch points and branch cuts are separated and isolated, and you can identify these, and you can then view this as the one instanton, two instanton, three instanton. So you can separately analyze these multi-instanton sectors using these methods. So the conformal map technique is frequently used. It's described in Zinder Stan's book on quantum field theory. But in fact, a uniformizing map gives you much higher precision, and it's exponentially higher precision. And here's just a plot showing that of a Borel transform as you approach a branch point at t equals minus one. There's some specific power that is known in this particular problem. And you see that using the uniformizing map, you can approach this value, which gives you the corresponding Stokes constant, to many more digits of precision than using the conformal map. There are many more things I could say, but I won't because I'm already over time. One particularly interesting thing is that these uniformizing maps enable you to cross branch cuts using an extrapolation. So you can start with a finite number of terms here of some expansion, cross a branch cut onto the next Riemann sheet, and then go around and then cross again onto the next Riemann sheet. And the way to do this is that this cut plane with the uniformizing map is mapped to this geodesic quadrilateral here. So this is something from just uniformizing map theorems. And going from sheet to sheet is implemented by doing a Schwarz reflection of this geodesic triangle to this image, which is the next sheet, and then the next sheet, and the next sheet, and the next sheet. And you can do this all within this unit disk. And so you can go around in principle as many times as you want onto different sheets. Here's a plot, the black, this is for a cube root branch cut. The black curve is this cosine curve of a given function crossing the sheet. Red is what you would get if you just used a Padé type extrapolation. And blue is if you use this uniformizing map. And this was just starting with something like 10 terms of the expansion. So you can see, you can cross, I think, three times a sheet here, just using that information, limited information. All right, so I'm sorry, there are other examples. Let me go to the conclusions. So at its core, the idea behind resurgence is that it's a way to systematically unify perturbative and non-perturbative analysis in physics. Main application in which I'm interested in is the context of quantum field theory and path integrals underlying quantum field theory that have some hope of encoding actual analytic continuation information, which you could then use to study problems like such as the sine problem or real-time strong coupling evolution or non-equilibrium evolution at strong coupling. I've discussed how with multiple parameters you can discuss phase transitions in some sort of thermodynamic large N limit. And we see that the form of this trend series changes dramatically as you cross a phase transition. And you can't see this if you just restrict your attention to trend series with one parameter, as a lot of the mathematics literature has. So this resurgence is very well understood in these contexts, but I would like to stress that some people think that it's just a property of asymptotic series, but in fact, these resurgent ideas apply directly in the context in the Borel plane where you're applying it to convergent series. And so we saw this already in these Ising-Morel correlators, the expansions were convergent, and yet they had this inherent resurgent trend series structure. And what I mentioned towards the end, I'm sorry, I had to rush through it rather quickly, is that if you use these resurgent ideas to develop new methods of extrapolation and analytic continuation, you actually discover that there's a surprising amount of non-perturbative information that you can decode from surprisingly little perturbative input. And so the reason this might be interesting is applications for evaluating with high precision things like critical exponents, but also there are just many interesting problems where the best we can hope to have is some small number, maybe 10 terms in an asymptotic expansion. And the question is, what can we make with that limited information? And all right, so let me stop there, thanks.
Okay, thank you for the beautiful talk, Gerald. Maybe we can take questions from the audience, if there are any.
Sure. Sorry about those technical
glitches. I have one question, a simple question. Can you comment a little bit on the physics of this Gross-Witten matrix model and what could you learn from some exploration analysis of it?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
So I use this illustration because it's the simplest example I know of where you can really study the full phase space of having large N and strong coupling and large N and weak coupling and fixed N and strong coupling. You can do all of these directions in great detail. The original analysis was in the N equals infinity limit. And so a reasonable question for applications to other systems, for example, would be, what can you learn? What's the structure of the not infinite NX limit, but the large N expansion, and are there, is there a trend series large N instanton expansion structure there? Okay, so that's the motivation. So the main point of this analysis that I showed you, the level of detail I showed you, is that indeed you can see the approach to the phase transition. So for example, if you use the say trend series analysis. Remember I said that there was a different trend series at weak coupling from strong coupling, right? There was this structure like this at strong coupling where you have a 1 over n asymptotic series in 1 over n, actually 1 over n squared, with exponentially small corrections, each with their own fluctuation. Whereas at strong coupling, the expansion looks like this. There's no perturbative large N expansion, it's immediately exponentially suppressed. And its powers of, its odd powers of these instanton terms only. And the strong coupling action is different from the weak coupling action. They're both trigonometric functions, but they're different trigonometric functions. And on both sides, you have this low order, large order, perturbative, non-perturbative relation between the large order growth of these and the low order terms here, the same sort of thing. All right, so what do we learn from this? So here's a transition. This specific heat is given by some derivatives of that expression that I just showed you. And we have something that is just completely flat on one side in the infinite N limit and has this structure in strong coupling. Well, at finite N, this is not a kink. it's only an actual phase transition at infinite n. But at finite n,
can you remind us of the physics of this plot? So there is a region where some eigenvalues are delocalized, right? So
yeah. So if you go back to the if you want it in that language, you can go back and think of this as some integral over the eigenvalues, and then you can ask, okay, which eigenvalues dominate this integral? And the answer is that in this large N limit, it's strong coupling or weak coupling, either real or complex eigenvalues dominate the phase transition. Dominate the physics. And as you cross the phase transition, you really go through this condensation of instantons that as you approach the phase transition, the one instanton approximation there is not very good. It needs to be upgraded to an all orders instanton approximation. And it's a different instanton approximation from either side. And as you resum them, these all orders of instantons, you meet at this phase transition when n is infinite. But if n is finite and large, you smooth out this kink in the specific heat to a smoothed out kink. But you see how the actual transition is generated only in the infinite n thermodynamic limit. If you then go, what this so-called double scaling limit zooms in on the actual phase transition. So if you expand around t equals one with deviations that depend on n as n to the two-thirds or three-halves, then that's taking the so-called double scaling limit where n disappears from the problem. You just have some double scaled parameter, and that's describing the immediate vicinity of the transition. And that's this Penn Levé 2. And interestingly, that's the same physics as describing the immediate transition of going from this non-perturbative tunneling to perturbative multiphoton. And it's the same physics as looking in the vicinity of this transition here. It's the same structure in these three cases, in the right at the vicinity of the phase transition. So that's why this is regarded as a universal transition. It's in some sense universal in the sense that in ordinary quantum mechanics, the behavior near a turning point is described uniformly by the Airy function, right? That's a uniform description of the location near a single turning point. Well, this Penn Levé 2 equation is the nonlinear version of the Airy equation. So in these nonlinear problems here, the way to describe the immediate vicinity of the transition point is with this double scaling limit, which reduces this Penn Levé 3 equation that I described to Penn Levé 2. So it's not just a property of this particular matrix model. This particular behavior is valid in transitions in many different classes of matrix models.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, are there any more questions for Gerald? Yeah, I don't see any, so maybe you can thank Gerald. Thank you for the talk. Maybe we can stop the recording.